Hello, welcome to the River Talk podcast hosted by Zach Collier, Priscilla Macy, and me, Eric Weiseth. This week, our kind of main topics are, well, just a bunch of things. So we also have a guest. Priscilla is out this week. So Zach, do you want to introduce our guest?
Yeah, this is my friend Aaron Cavagnolo. Aaron has been on the podcast before, and he's just an all-around badass guide who's guided around the world. So welcome, Aaron.
Thanks, Zach. I'm happy to be back.
Yeah. Thanks for being here.
So we always like to start the week off with news of the week. So Zach, do you have any news of the week?
Yeah, first some sad news. Here in Hood River, we had a fatality. A kayaker died on the Hood River on Saturday, and huge bummer for the whole community. And just a reminder that even on our local class 3-4 rivers, that anything can happen. So that's my first news, and nobody really knows the details. But it's a continuous river, and it was cold out there, so I'm sure those had some factor on that accident. And my other news is we're doing a Wild Rivers Night in Portland. We just announced the date. It's February 13th, and I think there's about 40 tickets left. And we're organizing it with Val from Leap. So thank you, Val, for putting it. Val's doing all the organizing and the hard work, so thank you, Val. Eric, you founded Leap. It's a nonprofit. Do you want to talk about Leap really quick?
So Leap is an organization my business partner and I and a couple other folks founded, a while back. And basically what we do is work with a variety of organizations. We work in Burn Center, New Avenues for Youth. There's a whole variety of organizations, but we have partner organizations. And we take their populations out for 5-day programs on the Lower Salmon, where, these populations of people that maybe wouldn't have the opportunity to go have that experience, for a variety of reasons, from socioeconomic to physical, and take them out and give them an opportunity to go through what can be really a life-changing experience of going on the river. The bulk of them paddle inflatable kayaks down the Lower Salmon. A lot of them, I've never been on a river before. The very first program we ever did was with the Oregon Burn Center, and we had one of the participants. She didn't know she was going to paddle inflatable kayak before she showed up. And as she put it at the time, she's like, the only thing that I was as scared of as fire, as a burn survivor, was water. And we put her in an inflatable kayak and she paddled down, and she came back and said that it was, one of the sort of key transformational moments of her life was conquering that fear. And that's kind of what we've been doing. We're, in like year 8 or 9 now, and we do about 10 programs a year. And Val is our program director, who actually leads the programs on the river.
Yeah, and I've got to know Val the last – you introduced me to her 2 years ago, and she's just a really impressive person and doing a really good job with Leap. And Leap, I've been very impressed by everything they do. So I'm really proud that this year's Wild Rivers Night, the proceeds are going to help that program. So it's pretty exciting.
So thanks, Zach, for doing that. It's been an amazing program. It's been amazing to watch how impactful river trips can be on people, at certain key moments in their life and in the journey that they're on, how much that experience can open them up to all sorts of transformations in their life. So
that's cool. My news of the week. Everything, Eric? Aaron?
Today, when we're recording this, the government is still shut down. Permit season, permit applications are going to be due here for a lot of rivers coming up at the end of the month, so about a week away. And, what happens after that from when do lotteries actually happen? When do people get notified of if they got something? Are there going to be a bunch of screw-ups because there's nobody managing the process right now? There's a lot of sort of question marks around what is going to happen with permits for all the, permitted rivers coming up. So my suggestion would be call your senators and tell them to get this thing shut down, get this open back up, I guess.
They're trying. I went to a town hall with Senator Wyden a couple days ago, and they're trying. They're doing their best. They know to do it. He basically said, he told the audience this, if you want to make a difference, find a friend of yours in Kentucky, any friend you can, and have them contact Mitch McConnell. That is the if you have any connection at all with Kentucky, that's what you need to do. But otherwise, they're doing the best they can.
If it stays happening, it's going to start having effects on the river industry. For us, we've got numerous permits that they're in the process of either renewing or, whatever happened. There's a lot of things that happen with our operational permits in the winter, and none of those things are going through right now. So it's impacted, you know, it has the impact of us being able to market, sell trips, and then ultimately run trips if it stays shut down in a long time. So hopefully this all gets solved quickly, because it's going to start having significant impacts on river guides, river guiding, and recreational river running. So,
yeah, I had a potential guest who I wanted to have come on with the Forest Service, and she just told me she can't be on anything. But the general answer is she doesn't know what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of, like, you start thinking about it, if it stays this way long enough, there's going to be people that end up leaving these jobs to go do other things. And so when they open back up, it's all like all of a sudden permit administrators or people who run these programs could have gone and found other things to do.
Yeah.
You know, low-level people especially. So it's nothing but bad for the river running community for this to continue.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. All right. Well, that's kind of all the news of the week. Although, Zach, I was skimming through, something came across my feed earlier about a boater being extracted off the Sandy River Gorge recently. Sounds like got separated from a boat and had to be vertically extracted out of the canyon.
Oh, I didn't hear that. I've heard multiple stories about this, but I haven't heard that part of the story.
Yeah, I think that was like a very recent update to the story, but the person was out, safe, fine.
Cool.
You know. But yeah, so took a swim, got separated from a boat, and had to be vertically pulled out of the canyon. So it sounded like so.
Yeah, I have this. I want to go on a little rant about all this stuff. Sorry, I just total aside.
Yes.
Love rants. I know. I just think that I shouldn't rant. Actually, never mind. But I'm going to anyway. Especially here in the Northwest, rivers are really continuous, and if you swim, the consequences can be really bad. And I just think that we need to be especially vigilant of the consequences of a swim on continuous rivers. And I think when I've been out boating lately, I've noticed people are pretty casual when they're on continuous rivers. So my rant is, if the river's continuous, there's extra safety precautions that need to be taken in terms of boat spacing and boat order and just paying attention. Rant over.
Wow. So that was a very nice friendly rant.
Aaron, do you want to add into that? Do you agree?
I think you said it well. Yeah, I mean, continuous rivers, like, yeah, you got to have a plan before you push off the shore, and you got to keep an eye on everyone, and boat order makes a big difference in those situations, so that you do have people at this as well, so you don't have to get someone vertically extracted out of the canyon, because that's less than ideal. Who knows how long he was waiting there before he got extracted, you know? And yeah, there can be a lot of problems. Yeah, that's like a minimal problem. Other things that could happen, that's not that bad, you know, for that person in the long haul, but still, it's taking a lot of resources.
Was that person boating by themselves? Do you know, Eric? Because
I don't.
I think if you had friends, that would
enough of those details.
I would think if you had friends, you could figure that problem out, right? Without having to be vertically extracted.
It depends on where you end up, though, right? Because Sandy Gorge, like, there's some spots that are tough. Like, if your friends or if you're the last boater and you end up, you know, swimming onto some, like, there are spots where I could see you getting pretty stuck.
Yeah. So I don't want to pretend I know what happened, or I'm not going to make any judgments because I don't know what actually happened. Just generally, continuous rivers like the Sandy Gorge is pretty continuous in there. Just it's nice to take extra safety precautions.
Yeah. Yeah. Another kind of last thing in the news is there was some high water recently. I think the Rogue got up to 64,000 or something. And there was a video floating around of some guys running Hellgate Canyon in an open drift boat with a kicker motor on the back. Whoa. And you see them come out of the bottom of the canyon, like, trying to bail water as fast as possible. So I would love to know the full story on that one, if anybody knows. There's a lot of fascinating choices that were made prior to the part of the video that I saw.
Yeah, were they doing that on purpose? Did they know
at 60,000? That's one of the fascinating questions I have. Who knows? It's hard to imagine you didn't do it on purpose, but it's also hard to imagine why you went in with a kicker motor at that water level in that section of canyon. But either way, it looked like the boat was right side up, and they were probably going to bail it before they went around the corner. So, and then I saw a video floating around of, was it Aaron Babcock running the Illinois at like 25,000 in creature crafts, which looked like awesome. Look, that I was watching and thinking, like, for the first time ever, like, man, I kind of want a creature craft. That looks like a really good time.
Yeah.
So Yeah, check that out. If you see it floating around, it's worth watching for sure. And that is the end of my news of the week.
Cool. Aaron, do you have any news?
Nope. Thanks, gentlemen.
Well, let's move on to our topics. Yeah.
Move on to the topics of the week. So we had a few topics of the week. There was an article about a blown neck gasket that Zach, you came across, I think. Zach, you want to give kind of a brief history of it?
Well, I think there were some people talking about blown neck gaskets, and somebody brought up whether it's good or bad and whether they cause fatalities. And I found in the American Whitewater Safety Database an example of somebody who blew a neck gasket or had a neck gasket that was duct taped together, I think, and they swam on the Illinois below Little Green Wall, and their suit filled up with water, and they just went downstream and passed away. And so I think there's been some debate lately as to whether it's – if you're wearing a neck gasket or if you're wearing a dry suit and there's a hole in it of some type and it fills with water, do you sink? And I've heard, yes, you sink, and I've heard, no, you don't sink. And I've always thought that if you – it's a huge danger to have a dry suit with a hole in it. Do you guys have any insights on that?
Well, it seems like it'd be the same reason you wouldn't want to swim in, like, it's pretty commonly accepted that wearing waders when you go rafting is a bad idea. You know, for the same reason, like, if you go in the river, all of a sudden you're wearing, like, a sea anchor, and a dry suit with a, you know, with your, like, P-flap open or a ripped out neck gasket essentially turns it into the same thing. Like, you're just wearing a giant sea anchor at that point. You know, your life jacket's going to help neutralize that buoyancy, but you still, it doesn't seem like a good thing.
It's water though. This is the part, I mean, I'm trying to wrap my brain around. It's water in your suit, which weighs the same as the water on the outside. So I don't see how it would take away from your buoyancy necessarily, but maybe it just drags you down somehow. That Earth acts like a sail for the current in some way.
When was the last time you went swimming in jeans?
More recently than you think,
right?
Like, yeah.
It sucks.
Zach, I think you have a point there. Is it doesn't change your mass, but it doesn't change your like buoyancy, but it changes your mass, right? So all that mass is with you now. So like if you go over a drop, you're going to go a lot deeper than if your dry suit's full of water.
Oh, that makes sense.
Full of water will it actually get? That's a whole nother question. Because I hear people talking about the waders too, and I've heard two sides of discussion on the wader thing where people say, no, the waders don't really increase your risk of drowning. You can swim in waders. And so I've heard the argument both ways on waders too, which I feel like waders would be way more dangerous than a dry suit with a hole in it. I mean, how much do we have any more information on the person on the Illinois who drowned? I mean, it sounds like no one picked him up.
Yeah, I think so. He had a head of the boats. I think that was the issue.
So it sounds like it could have been exposure too. And was just able to swim and how, you know, if they pick him up like hours later, I bet his dry suit's totally full of water because he's been floating in the water. And then at that point, they're like, oh my gosh, his dry suit's so heavy, but I wonder how quickly it filled with water.
Yeah, like it could have been exposure more than it was just sinking.
Mm-hmm.
The article had made it sound like that, you know, they didn't pick up, there was two people in it was like a paddle raft or something, and the other person ended up swimming for like miles before they picked the person up is what the article said. So, and that water in there is fast. I mean, talk about a pretty constant section of water.
I mean, below Little Green Wall is kind of a flat time. So you have a good, I don't know, a quarter mile. I can't remember. Aaron, you might remember better than I can. But after Greenwald, there's some flat water. So you're not going to the rapids right away.
So there's a little drop, and then there's that flat. It's busy water, depending on the flow, though. So, yeah. I mean, it's flat between that, where there's that narrow little gorge. But before and after, there's a rapid right after Greenwald. And then there's that little gorge where it's mellow. And then a little bit of rapid, and you come around the corner. And then it's just rapid, rapid, rapid. Once you get around that bend, and the river bends back to the right. Yeah. It's pretty consistent down through there.
So I think they had a problem in Little Green Wall, which is common. I think there's more problems in Little Green Wall than Green Wall, actually, because you don't scout it. You kind of go into it, you know, and it's a weird rapid. And somebody in the lead, but I think they flipped. I'm actually pulling up the article right now. And it was the trip rose from 1,700 to 17,000 when they were on the trip.
Oof.
And, yeah, they planned they missed the takeout eddy above Little Greenwald the Scout, and they capsized, and they were both underwater. One guy had a dry suit neck gasket with duct tape, and then he entered the water, and the seal blew out. And the water came in, making it hard for him to swim. That's what it says. And so...
But the guy died. How did they even know that? They never talked to him about it.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. He was carried 5 miles downstream before he reached shore.
It does seem like an assumption you can make is that if your dry suit is full of water, it's the same thing, though. It's all of a sudden, like, even your swimming maneuvering, you're kicking and you're moving your arms, which swimming in high water is hard enough to actually go anywhere, like breaking across eddy lines, getting, you know, sucked down if boils, that kind of stuff is really challenging. But then all of a sudden you're having to, every time you kick, you're moving a lot more mass because you have water in your dry suit, or like lifting your arms to swim if you've got water in your dry suit. All those things get a lot harder, not to mention the exposure piece. Like,
yeah, I think the exposure piece is huge. And who knows, he could have hit his head and gone unconscious, and, you know, because nobody's talked to him about what happened. They found him a few miles downstream. So the whole story is not there. But the exposure piece is huge. I was on the Hood River Saturday, the same day that fatality happened. We didn't see it, but we were there stand-up paddleboarding. And I swam a handful of times because, you know, stand-up paddleboarding is swimming. And, you know, even my short, like, 30-second swims, my energy in my dry suit, my energy was zapped quickly. I'd get back on the board and be exhausted after a 30-second swim. So, you know, you take a 30-second swim and your dry suit fills with water. I mean, you don't have energy to swim pretty quickly.
Yeah. So wait, was the river flowing 17,000 CFS when this happened?
Well, this is where these examples of with a lot of these reports, there's not information, but it says it rose from 1,700 to a high of over 17,000. So it's hard to say what the flow was when they were at Little Greenwald, but they missed the eddy above it, which it's not, you know, it's a pretty easy eddy to catch at normal flows.
Well, so, I'll say anything over 5,000 in there is like...
Yeah,
that's good. If you split up and swim, you're gonna have a hard time getting to shore, particularly for 10,000. I mean,
yeah.
So I think the interesting question to me comes out of this. I mean, obviously this is a tragedy, and you know, there's all sorts of conversations about should you not. But there's like, how many times have you been in a put in where, like, somebody's putting on a dry suit and their wrist gasket or their neck gasket like blows out in the process of putting it on, or you show up and it's like, oh shit, I forgot my paddle. Well, let's pull the breakout, our breakdown paddle out of somebody's boat, and you can paddle with that. Or, you know, like, when, at what point, like, what are the decisions where it's like, okay, you walk off the trip. Like, you don't launch today because this thing happened. And how many times do you push that limit? I know, like, I've been on a guide training on the North Umpqua, which is like a class 3, you know, with a little bit of 4 river, doing IK trainings. And I blew out a neck gasket, putting my dry suit on, but I still went. But I just remember thinking, like, all right, if you swim, you are wearing a drowning suit now, so don't swim. You know, it's like, I don't know. That to me is the interesting question, is what are the things that play into the decision to go, not go?
Yeah.
Something like that.
When you get to the pit in Illinois, you drove a long way.
Yeah.
That is not a short drive. And then if one person can't go, you know, these guys, it sounds like they are two-ing. There's two people in a raft. Does one person just not go? That means the other person doesn't go. There's a lot of pressure to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think
that plays into it. Like, those remote trips, it's easier to get pressured into doing that.
Yeah.
For sure.
I don't think I've ever not gone on that trip because of something like that. I can't think of one. Have you guys, other than Umpqua? Or did you went on the Umpqua. Have you guys ever got to put in, like, oh, we don't have our first aid kit, let's just not go?
Not yet. But I'd say high water, I've been to put in and we've canceled the trip because the water was high and we're like, no, this isn't safe. I've done that, and we just said, we're going to bag it.
I did that on the T at 16,000. I'm guessing your story's the same, Aaron.
Mine's lower, but yeah. Same idea there. Yeah, get down there and you're like, no, it's too high.
Yeah.
So, sorry, go ahead, guys.
I've been on a trip where, like, you know, somebody showed up without their spray skirt, and obviously wasn't able to go.
Yeah. You're like, oh, awesome, shuttle driver.
Yeah, exactly. But I can't think of other equipment.
Helmet? I mean, PFD, you definitely shouldn't go. helmet is one where you're like, maybe you're gonna not. I wouldn't go kayaking, but would you raft? Maybe like the wind if you forgot your helmet.
Yep.
The wind is right on the line.
Yeah, North Fork American, same thing.
I'd probably still go, but maybe not.
Yeah. You say kayak or raft?
I definitely would never kayak without a helmet. I just wouldn't go. I did forget my helmet one time when I was going to kayak Poly Creek in California, which is there's some waterfalls and stuff, and I wore my bike helmet. No, I didn't forget my helmet.
But you looked awesome.
It was me or somebody else. It might have been the person I was with. One of us wore a bike helmet. It was so long ago, I can't remember who it was. But it was just two of us. We wanted to go really bad, and so one of us wore a bike helmet.
Yeah, I wouldn't hard shell without a helmet.
Yeah,
I'll IK without a helmet.
Yeah, like that makes sense.
One interesting thing about this conversation, have you guys ever tried just like in the summer, like putting some water, you know, like not zipping your dry suit all the way up and getting in and try to swim around for a while in it?
No.
Like I feel like we that would be a good thing to try just to see like, well, what is it actually like? What actually happens? And
yeah. What if you sink?
You're not going to sink. I mean, you're net positive with the life jacket. I wouldn't go anyplace really gnarly, you know, but I'd float a little like class one plus two ripple and try to catch an eddy or something like that, or in some big pool, just try to swim around in a big pool.
I'm not going to do it because I might sink. But if you guys want to do it, I'm super supportive.
You're not going to sink, Zach.
Let's do Upper Gliese this summer, like in July when the water's warm.
Yeah,
let's do a dry suit full Upper Gliese run.
I'll do it in a pool where I can touch the bottom and still keep my head above water. But that's it. I'll do shuttle for you guys. You guys should do it. I'll do shuttle.
Zach, they should take away your engineering degree for that response.
The engineering here is complicated. I get it. But the engineering on this one, the science is a little bit complicated. And there's a slight chance you'll sink. I don't want to take that slight chance.
It doesn't work that way. You've got a life jacket. You can't sink, okay, Zach. You're not going to sink in flat water.
I value my life.
Water.
I value my life very highly.
In your dry suit.
I have a degree in engineering, but I might have not taken a particular class and missed something. And I don't want to take a chance that on my life, on my ability to do engineering. Can I tell you guys a story though, like this? And I was on the Tuolumne at 8,000, and Aaron and I have done the Tuolumne together 8,000 a couple times, and it's a pretty big flow for that river. And we were scouting Gray's Grindstone, which I can't remember why we were scouting it, but we were. It's a big rapid. I mean, somebody's died there. When my first year guiding, I think in 98, a guide died swimming at Gray's Grindstone. And I went to take a leak, and I opened my P-zipper, took a leak, and my P-zipper wouldn't shut. It was stuck open. And so I had to make a decision. And I have to keep going. I can't hike out of the Tuolumne. So do I take my dry suit off and be exposed to the elements, or do I wear a dry suit with an open P-zipper?
Tell me you duct taped it.
I should have. That would have been smart. I didn't duct tape it. That would have been the right move. I was on a different trip where somebody had a piece of it broke and they duct taped it. After my trip, you know, when you're you're guiding and you're in a huge rush, you don't have time to, hey guys, let's pull over and duct tape my P zipper because we had to keep moving. So I probably should have done that. So I wore my dry suit with the P zipper open the rest of the way. At pretty high level. So that was my debate, but yeah, duct taping would have been smart.
Yeah, that would have freaked me out.
At the top of Gray's that'd be terrifying.
Yeah, because swimming there would be terrible. There is that left line at 8,000, so it's a little less terrifying. But if I had to run the middle line where people flip in the entrance a lot, I would have definitely been a lot more scared. So anyway, I think the moral of the whole story is we should be replacing our gaskets on a regular basis. And duct taping gaskets is probably not a good idea. It keeps you – I think that what we're learning in some of these discussions are if you duct tape it, it keeps you against your neck when you're paddling so you're not taking water in. So it's serving its purpose. It's keeping you dry and healthy if you're not swimming. But if you do swim, there's a chance that it could – the duct tape could break or it could tear somewhere else if it's that old and become a hazard.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the big moral is we should be replacing our neck gaskets on a regular basis, even if they're not torn.
Gosh, that's such a miserable process. It's tough to justify. Like, all right, I'm going to go cut my neck gasket and go through the replacement process for one that is still working. I could see myself having a hard time justifying that, even though I think you're right.
But you start to see they kind of fray a little bit when they're about to
go.
Yeah. You're like, yeah. When they start to have a little bit of frayness, it's a safety thing. It's time to get it replaced.
Yeah. Now, the zipper one to me is like the bigger, you know, like your zipper gets stuck. Like mm-hmm. we were on in Illinois and I was taking my dry suit off like night one, you know, we camped above Greenwall somewhere and my zipper got all sorts of wonky and stuck. And I was looking at like the main primary zipper and I was like, like this could be a super ugly scenario if I can't figure out. And ultimately I was able to kind of like weasel it back together. But yeah, I just remember thinking like this could suck. Like this could be a catastrophic failure for the rest of this trip. But
I've had that happen before.
Somebody's got to come up with a good solution.
I have a solution. I've had it happen before. I've had people – like we have guests on our Illinois trips rent dry suits or bring dry suits, and I've had them break. And so it's happened enough to me where we now bring – I bring backup wetsuits for people to have dry suits.
Yeah.
So then if your dry suit breaks, a zipper breaks, and that gasket breaks, just go do a wetsuit.
But on a private trip, do you do that?
No, but I probably should. I think if I thought of it, I would. If I'm like, oh, yeah, it's a big group, we should throw a wetsuit in, I probably would. I have wetsuits. I mean, that's the thing is, like, I own a bunch, so it's easy. The average person doesn't own, you know, 20 wetsuits to bring a couple sizes. But it's a good idea because dry suits do malfunction, and then they become a hazard.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, shall we move on to our next topic of conversation?
Yeah.
So, also real quick, we did get an email with someone asking about directions on just a quick in note here. We got an email asking about directions on switching the Lynx floors from an air floor to a foam floor and, how to do that. And I just got an email from Jacob, says he was mistaken about the conversation. The guy he thought had already had a foam floor, but he upgraded it to a mini cell. So, he's not sure about the conversion from an air floor to a foam floor, but that the people to contact are Andy and Bax in Portland. Hmm. So if that interests you, that's
cool.
That's where to go for that. So our next topic, kind of on the random bucket list, was big truck or truck and trailer.
This is
a great title.
This is Aaron's topic, and I'm going to preface it with, I think Aaron, you and I talked about this a couple weeks ago. If you're carrying a bunch of stuff, do you just buy a massive truck or do you buy a normal truck and get a trailer? And I'm just going to give my opinion first and then you guys can talk about it all you want. Get a truck and trailer. That's the point of trailers, is you can put more stuff in them. I'm done. You guys can.
Are we talking like – so let me understand this conversation. Are we talking like a flatbed trailer to put your raft on or versus like throwing your raft on top of your car? Kind of, is that the conversation that we're having?
I don't know. That's a good question. I was thinking more like on a larger scale than that. Like, do you get a bigger vehicle so you can put all your stuff in the back of it, or do you go with a little bit smaller vehicle and then have a trailer so that you can tow the stuff you need for the river? And I mean, there's the commercial aspect of it, and there's a private aspect. So those are two different things. But it seems like in general, Zach's all about the truck and trailer. Yeah, Eric, I'm curious your thoughts.
Well, so this conversation came up on boater thread or something on Facebook where some dude had moved from the East Coast and was like living in Boise, and he gets on and says, "Why does everybody have trailers? Why don't you just throw your rafts on top?" And he had like a Suburban or something, you know, with a rack on top. And like, just throw your raft on top of your rig, and then you don't have to back. It's easier, like all this stuff. And there was some extreme feelings on the positive nature of trailers here in Idaho.
In Boise in particular, I'm sure there are. Uh-huh.
Well, and that's kind of the point that this guy eventually, if I remember the thread right, sort of brought up, was that, you know, back in wherever he was from on the East Coast, like, nobody used trailers, like, for private boating. It was all throw stuff on top of your truck and go. And I'm a believer in trailers. Like, it's easy. Backing a trailer is not that hard. Driving a trailer is not that hard. Spend the time and learn, and then you don't have to lift your stuff as far. Like, it's easy. So I'm a trailer fan. I'm a fan of the trailers. So I don't like lifting things that far. I like to put them on top of my car. It just feels like a lot of work. So
yeah,
that's my jam.
Yeah, it seems like it varies by area. It seems like Oregon and Idaho are big into trailering, and then like California, they're big into I think they just throw stuff in their vehicles. Like, you don't see very many people driving around with rafts on trailers in California, even when you get up to the river. You know, it's just like maybe the commercial companies do that, but everyone else is throwing them in the back of their trucks and whatnot.
And, well, I do think in Idaho, even, you see there's still trailers, but stuff is like rolled up inside the trailer. So that's the other piece for me, is like I'm going to roll my equipment, you know, like forget like take hard shells out, but like your rafts and that kind of stuff. You see a lot of folks, it's like, I'm going to have all my stuff rolled up and put in my truck or put in my trailer or whatever. And then I'm going to get to the put in. I'm going to have to blow it all up, rig it all together, all of that. And that's a big part of why I'm for the trailer, is just it makes life so much easier at the put in. You've got your stuff all blown up. You're not having to use some funky little pump that's attached to your car battery that may or may not work. Mm-hmm. You know, to get your stuff going. Although in Idaho, because of the lengths of the shuttles, a lot of even the commercial companies are using, like, you know, horse trailers or box trailers and keeping their stuff rolled up inside just so it doesn't get as haggard on the drive arounds.
Yeah, totally. But I think those are two separate things too. You're talking about on the long trips, everyone puts it in, like, inside. But if you look around Boise, everyone's got their raft on a
Aaron, we're losing you here.
What's that?
Oh, sorry. That didn't come through. Say it again.
Yeah, it did a little bit. Yeah, I was saying, like, well, in Idaho, I think there's a difference, too, in the longer trips versus, like, the day trips. Like, people in Boise, they all have trailers with the rafts inflated on it, and they go up and run sections of the Payette and whatnot. And also, it seems to me, it's like how your put-ins and takeouts are. If you can, like, splash a trailer in the back and just pull your boat up on, then you're much more likely to have a trailer. But if you do that, then you're like, well, it becomes yet less useful. And then in certain areas, like I think California, driving is a pain in the ass. And so people are more inclined just to throw the stuff in the back of the vehicle, because driving around with a trailer is difficult and it's much more challenging. And they don't want to deal with it. But like, you know, Oregon and Idaho, you don't quite have I guess Portland can be pretty busy, but a lot of places are a little slower and it's easier to have a trailer and drive around.
I also wonder how property, you know, plays into it, like property prices, like having the space to store a trailer and keep your stuff on a trailer probably also plays into that a little bit. I also wonder, when you think about Oregon and Idaho specifically, there's a, you know, this rich history of like drift boating, you know, and that, like hard boats from way back in the day in the States. And so both the infrastructure from a boat ramp standpoint, you know, there's a lot of places that are designed around that, but then sort of, there's just a history of boats being on trailers, but I wonder if that's part of it too, is just sort of this historical use trends.
I think though in California, a big difference is people drive Priuses and Subarus in California. There aren't as many truck drivers, and that's a huge stereotype, but it's pretty true.
There's a lot of trucks, and there's a surprising number of trucks in California.
Okay, but, so it's a wrong stereotype. But also, when I think of the put-ins and takeouts of the Cal, if I think of a Tuolumne, that road's not exactly fun to drive with a trailer, the put-in or takeout, because if to pass a car, it's hard. North Fork American, for example, there's not even anywhere really to turn a trailer around at put-in or takeout. Mm-hmm. So it's in the roads, that road to put-in and takeout is tough. A lot of the runs you do in California have kind of epic shuttles and a lot of weird dirt roads. So just maneuvering a trailer is hard. We're here in Oregon and especially Idaho, you know, we have typically pretty nice roads to our put-ins. We're not driving crazy back roads.
Yeah, I kind
of
feel
the exception of the Oahe takeout.
The Oahe takeout. Yeah,
the lower Oahe, Birch Creek.
Yeah,
driving down through the creek bed.
Yeah, but you could pass another, you know, a lot of California ones. Like there, you just kind of like, if you need somebody to pass, you can kind of pull over, back up a little bit. A lot of them in California, you're on the side of a cliff, you know, so having to back a trailer up 100 feet along a cliff so somebody else can pass you is tough, you know. So even Birch Creek, I'm not as worried about a trailer there as if I was doing the Tuolumne, for example.
Now, change the topic a little bit. One reason I asked this question is because, you know, I've worked for a lot of outfitters over the years, and it seems like all the outfitters on the Grand Canyon, they just run huge-ass trucks with no trailer. And you go to Idaho, and just about everyone runs a trailer. Oregon, everyone has a trailer. And that's one of the other reasons I was curious. You guys are both outfitters. And I don't know if you've known that about like the Arizona scene. And I was curious your guys' thoughts on that from more of a commercial perspective.
But what's a big ass truck?
Like the Oars truck on the Rogue? Like the big box truck, you know, like, yeah, I know. Well, they run like semi trucks with those huge flatbeds on them, a lot of them.
Yeah, like huge truck, like yeah, that we can fit seven people in the cab, and it's like step up into it. I don't know how big they are. They're massive trucks,
and you can fit everything in the back of the truck without a trailer.
Oh yeah, everything. Yeah, and then we've got bigger ones now than we used to get in there. But yeah, you can run a 6-foot trip easily and put all the gear in the back for 2 weeks.
Well, Zach, you've seen the Oars truck on the Rogue.
Yeah, but they have a trailer too.
But they just put their rafts. Their rafts are basically empty, I think, on the trailer.
Yeah,
All their gear is inside that big box.
Is their truck like Arda's, or is it way bigger than that?
Way bigger.
Yeah, that might be one of their old Grand Canyon rigs then, because I know I think in Idaho, don't they have an? I think they have a huge rig, they have a pretty big rig there. It's not huge though. Like I say, the ones down in Arizona are like a third. The flatbed part of the truck is like a third longer than what Oars is up in Idaho.
I mean, I think
they have like lift gates on them, and you know,
A difference is the roads though. I think isn't the Grand Canyon pretty much paved, put in takeout nice roads.
Takeout's gnarly because you go out. It depends if you do Pierce's Ferry. Pierce's Ferry, I think, is a little better, but a lot of outfitters take out and go out Diamond Creek, and Diamond Creek is always a mess. Yeah, a lot of trucks break down on that thing.
And you have to deflate the boats, right, to put them in the truck?
Yeah, you deflate and roll them.
Yeah,
you deflate and roll. I think most of the outfitters deflate and roll. The ore trips, they deflate and roll. On the motor trips, they do actually, they keep it on the trailer, but that's a whole different scene because it's just one huge boat on the trailer, and they got a little cab that they tow it out with, and basically it's all pre-rigged. But yeah, for all the ore trips, they roll the boats.
So I think it has to do with logistics, right? So on the Middle Fork, we have a sweep boat, so we have to put on a trailer. We're not going to deflate and roll a sweep boat. And some outfitters do. We're not going to. Ours is hard to put together. On the Rogue, we don't want to deflate and roll boats every single time. These are 4-day turnarounds, so it's just an insane amount of work. So putting them on a trailer just saves work. If the guides didn't mind deflating and rolling them all the time, I'd be into this huge truck thing. Although, would that be obnoxious having a huge truck over Bear Camp Road, Eric?
Yes. Yeah, I think it's that, you know, that's the thing. It's always intimidating going over Bear Camp and coming around the corner and having the Oars truck staring at you, like coming down the hill at you. Like, I mean, they do it safely and everything else. I'm not questioning their judgment on safety, but it's certainly, I've driven some motorhomes because of our shuttle business over Bear Camp, and that's super intimidating.
Yeah.
And I don't, you know, we don't do that very often. So to do that regularly with a lot of gear just doesn't sound too appealing to me. But,
And in the Grand
Canyon, in Idaho for a while, like the Maine, you'd be hard pressed to drive some of those rigs into like the takeout for the Maine because of the bridge.
Oh yeah.
Now the Manning Crevice has changed. Like that's more open, but you know, it's sort of the same thing. Like those roads are tough on those big, big vehicles like that.
Aaron, in the Grand Canyon, are there drivers or do guides drive this big truck?
There's drivers.
Yeah.
Which that's a whole nother thing. I'm a big fan of the driver. I think having a driver is way easier on your rigs than letting guides drive it. Having watched a lot of guides drive rigs over the years and like watching them burn out clutches as they like back into trailers. That's one of the reasons I'm not a big fan of the trailer is because of just trying to hook the trailer up. They just wear out the clutch, just trying to get it back into position when they take the trailer off back at the warehouse or whatever. I'm a fan of the driver. I think it's a lot easier on the vehicles, but it takes a spot out of your rig, which is a ball game.
And you have to have a driver.
Mm-hmm.
Like so for us, like in the Middle Fork, we have a small operation. We're just running one trip every 8 days. I can't hire a driver that's just going to work 2 days a week. And so that, you know, just finding somebody that can do only 2 days a week of driving is tough.
Yeah, that's true.
So I like vehicles that our guides can drive, and it's more efficient. It's easy. So a big
truck. Yeah, there's positives on both sides of that. To me, the deal killer becomes like with those big rigs. Yeah, then you have to have CDLs and air brake certifications and some of that kind of stuff on those. So then having a driver, it becomes much easier to justify the complications that come with that. Of do we have to shuttle a second vehicle because we don't have, you know, space now in this vehicle for all the guides plus the driver. that one, that becomes a complication, you know, by adding that driver in. Mm-hmm. So we've stayed away from some of those specialized or the vehicles requiring special certifications, just from that standpoint, that it gives me less freedom and flexibility to deal with, you know, what the staffing situations.
Do you ever like, do you ever just like close your eyes and like pray when you see the person who's driving out of the parking lot and you're just like, oh gosh, I hope they, you know, they don't destroy the truck on the way to put in.
I don't, but I know who my drivers are. I know who my guides are who are driving and I hire for
so
that.
So not all your guides drive, Zach?
I don't let all of them drive. I usually only have two on a crew that I feel are at that level. Like it depends if it's the full truck and trailer or if it's empty too. You know, there's only usually a couple of guides that are comfortable enough driving a big truck with a big trailer full. And then, you know, anybody can drive it if it's empty. But here's the thing, our main truck in Idaho is a stick. And you're right, Aaron, we replaced the clutch after 36,000 miles. We bought a new and after 36,000 miles we replaced a clutch. So it does get worn out mainly probably because of backing. You're right. But if your vehicle's a stick, not everybody can drive stick. Only people who are pretty experienced people can drive stick. So it limits who ends up driving the vehicle. So it's the stick is good and bad.
Do you have people who are like, oh, I want to be able to drive the truck too. I want to learn to drive it and I don't know how to drive a stick. What do you say? You're like, to drive a stick on your own first and then you can get on company gear? Or how do you handle that?
Well, I probably ruined a couple clutches and also have jackknifed a couple trailers because I've helped people learn how to drive sticks and backup trailers on our gear. So now I'm switching automatic because I'm like realizing it's just hard to teach people how to drive stick anymore. And it's expensive. And then our new truck that's automatic, then it's not going to limit who can drive it. But I'm pretty careful about, you know, who drives it. And I think our guides, you know, the rest of the people in the car also want to be with a good driver. They're going to say something like if somebody's not a good truck driver, they're going to also be like, hey, we only want these, you know, these people driving when the truck is full or on certain roads.
Yeah, I found that crews, like I very rarely have to have that conversation because the crews regulate themselves mm-hmm. pretty well. You're right. Like the person, I would say more often than not, like our head guide either is driving or is selecting who's driving pretty specifically like for those reasons that they want to be in a car that's safe. But yeah, it's, I mean,
do you guys run sticks too?
I haven't bought a stick. No, basically I don't think I've bought a car that's a stick, in the last like 12 years. And we've had that conversation. It's just, it's to Zach's point, like I get fewer and fewer people that come in the door knowing how to drive them. And we have an old, I've got a, what is it? A 92 F-250 with a 4-speed that is probably one of the more challenging sticks out there to drive. And I've probably taught, you know, 30 guides over the years how to drive a stick on that truck.
Is that orange truck that I want?
Yeah, Tonka.
Oh, I love that truck.
I do too. It's caught on fire with me inside of it twice and has died on me a number of times. We have a fickle relationship, but I do love her. Yeah. She's my favorite. But so I've taught a lot of guides how to drive sticks, you know, for different reasons. But as far as like new vehicles, we don't do it.
That seems like the way to go. I mean, one of my good friends, he works in the insurance industry, and he's told me that sticks are not getting stolen anymore because people don't know. He says that there's been a huge drop in the rate of stealing of sticks because no one can drive sticks anymore. So everyone steals automatics now. So if you're driving a stick, you have to worry less about people stealing it. Now, I don't know up in Merlin, but in big city living.
I'm pretty sure in Merlin, everybody can drive a stick.
I actually saw a meme of that the other day. It was like, it was a picture of like a stick in a car and it said like anti-theft device.
So this
somebody did steal Tonko from us. I don't know, like it was probably 15 years ago, but it broke down like 20 miles out of town. That's what we found it to be.
Anti-theft device too.
Yeah.
So Dodge this year, this is the 2019 Dodges, the ones coming out right now. They don't make stick anymore. And Dodge was the last large truck brand to have sticks still. So you cannot buy a brand new truck anymore that's manual. Everything's automatic now moving forward.
Wow.
So that makes that easy if you're going to buy new trucks.
Yeah. All right. So the last, our last topic, and I think that in some ways the last conversation around trailers will speak into this one a little bit.
Yeah.
Disappearance of paddle boating. Zach, explain your topic.
So this is Aaron's topic. I'll give 2 cents about it and let Aaron take over. I've noticed it too. When I started guiding, paddle boating was just what we did. It was rad. And you went and did cool adventures with your friends in a paddle boat. Aaron and I have done a bunch of these trips together, actually. We, you know, Giant Gap and Forks of the Kern and you know, private boating, some cool stuff. And guides, you know, there's a lot of pride in California in paddle boating. And I've noticed private boating has moved more towards R2ing. And I think it's because the two people are active and not paddle boating. But also guiding, more and more guides are doing paddle assists. You know, I remember in California, on the Tuolumne, we do 6 or 7 people in a paddle boat on the Tuolumne all the time. And now when I see photos, almost everybody has a stern frame on the lower Tuolumne. Or, you know, on the Rogue, we used to do paddle boats in the Rogue. And I don't think I've seen a paddle boat in the Rogue for 10 years. They always have oars in the back. So I think there's just not the pride in paddle boating there used to be, you know, back in maybe like 10 years ago. Does that sum it up, Aaron? Is that about right?
Yeah, it seems like there's this movement towards, as you said, on the commercial side, there's a movement towards everyone taking oar paddle assists. And then private boating, it seems like everyone wants to cat boat now on the private side. There doesn't seem like there's a lot of paddle boating going on the West.
R2ing is huge right now. I think
I feel like R2ing is huge with those cat, like the cat paddle boat things.
Or even just, you know, even just regular rafts, there's so many people with air 130 double D's or whatever R2ing. Here in the Northwest, for sure, you go to the Clackfest. Last year, we had maybe 8 people in the cataract race, and there were 22, 25 boats in the R2 slalom.
Wow. So,
and you go to put in for the wind, and there's a ton of people R2ing. And that is traditionally a cat boat run. So I'm seeing R2ing explode.
Hmm. Well, that seems to make sense in a lot of ways. R2ing is really nice. I mean, just bring a couple paddles and pump up your boat and you're good to go. Yeah. Or just throw it on top of your truck or pull it behind your trailer.
I think that's actually I see the real appeal on the R2 side is the ease. It's like, it's very little equipment. It's a boat and a couple paddles. And you're right, you don't need a trailer. Like, you can just throw it on top of your car, where the second you add a frame, oars,
yeah,
like all that stuff, the equipment, like the weight goes up, your cost goes up, you know, throwing it on top of your truck is a whole lot harder. So just from an ease standpoint, R2ing makes a lot of sense.
And you only need one friend. You don't have to find 4 friends to go out boating for the day. 4 friends that are just going to sit there and paddle based on what you tell them to do. Where R2ing, both people are typically actively engaged.
And I mean, R2ing is not that hard. Let's be honest. Like, if you just sit in the bottom of the boat, it's usually going to bounce down the rapid. You know, like you put oars on your boat and you're trying to row and then it catches a rock, you can hit you in the face. Like, oars are way more dangerous than R2ing. And then if you put 6 or 7 people in a boat, then it's way heavier and way more out of control, and you're way more likely to have problems there too. So I feel like R2ing is the best of all worlds. You don't have to call a bunch of friends. They'll just bounce down the rapid. It's really easy to get to put in and get your gear going and get on the water.
I think the most interesting trend is R1ing, which at first seemed like a terrible idea to me. And more people are just by themselves in a raft and doing great. So I think that's the more interesting trend.
That sounds really sad though, Zach.
Sad because you don't have any friends? It's like kayaking, but you're in a rubberized container.
Yeah, it's like kayaking in a double kayak by yourself.
Yeah. Saddest
of the kayaks.
Yeah, but so I tried it this year. I've done it twice now on the white salmon, and it's hard. You have to be a good paddler. It takes a lot to make that boat go straight and build momentum. I thought it was really interesting to do. And I did it because I had to take a raft out and I had nobody to go with me. So I'm like, I'll just go by myself. I didn't have any friends. But I ran into, the first time I did it, I was putting it on the middle white salmon. And I put on, and then Aaron Erdick, who's a really good boater and R1 boater, had just finished the truss, and he saw me at the bottom of Maytag or Top Drop, whatever that rapid's called, and he caught up with me and paddled that. He was going to take out just there, but he saw me and he caught up, and he was R1ing, and it was fun to swap stories with him, and he had just R1'd the truss, and it's something he does on a day-to-day basis. and does really well. So I think that's the more interesting trend.
That's super impressive. I've seen, you know, I didn't really even know that was a thing. And then we had, his name will come back to me. He's a guide in Southern Oregon who does some trips for us every now and then. You know, he was basically coming on to do kind of like a training trip with us on the nugget section. And we were like, well, do you want, here's, you know, we'll give you some oars and a stern frame and throw some coolers full of water in the front of your boat and see how you do. And he was like, no, I don't want the oars. I'm just going to R1 it. It's like, you're going to do what? Excuse me? Is that a, I don't understand what you're saying right now. And he went and just like cleaned everything. Like it was really impressive. It's impressive to watch because you have to be such a good like reader. I feel like you have so much less power and ultimately I would argue control that you have to be better at reading water and utilizing currents and stuff. And it's impressive to see somebody who's really good at it.
Yeah.
Because you can't make it up as much as you can with other things, I think.
What I found hard was you can't point the boat straight and build momentum.
Yeah.
Because if you paddle, the boat turns. And so there's some J strokes you can do and there's some drawing you can do. But if you're on the river right and you have to get the river left, it's really hard to go in a straight line to get over there. You have to think way ahead of time and really use the waves and currents really well to keep your boat straight to build momentum.
Yeah. So back to our topic, on the commercial side, I would argue Oregon, California, Idaho, that you've seen, I personally feel like I've seen a disappearance of the paddle boat. Like the true guide stick paddle boat is not a thing. And for us, like in the decisions we've made commercially, I've looked at it for a couple of reasons. One, having clients go into like flat water, like, so like the Rogue, which is essentially a, you know, pool drop with lots of long pools, or like the Salmon, same thing. Having to sort of like whip people on the back to get them to paddle into the wind on flat sections is not a very fun experience for your guests. And so a big part of our decision making was like, we just don't want to have to be mean to our guests to get to where we want to go against the wind. So having oars on the back just allows your guide to do the work and it makes the experience a lot better for your clients. And two, there's the control factor of, you know, your guide can sort of make up for shortcomings of, you know, anybody on the boat. You got a boat full of kids and they can't paddle or whatever it is. Your guide really has the capacity to make up that distance from the back. But I do feel like you see, you know, you go to Colorado or you go, you know, for at least from the videos and the sense that I get, like on the East Coast, you still see a huge group of like traditional, like we interviewed a dude from Colorado the other day and almost everything that he's done is like old school, like guide stick paddle boating from a commercial standpoint. And I kind of wonder why that market is different in those places.
I think that day trips paddle boating makes a lot of sense and it's more fun for people. People want to control the boat and take pride and ownership of it. In Colorado, they do a ton of day trips. It's all whitewater. There's a huge amount of pride in paddle boating. And great paddleboat guides come from Colorado. Like I love hiring Colorado guides because they have so much experience paddleboating and they want to do it. Where I think a lot of guides, what I find here in Oregon and California, not all of California, but some of California, they want to paddleboarding them as oar paddle assist.
Mm-hmm. Aaron, Zach, why do you still run paddle boats?
Because they're rad. We run them on the Middle Fork.
You run them on the Middle Fork?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And you can't, and so we have guides who come to us with no paddleboarding experience, want to work the Middle Fork, and you put them in a paddle boat and they're just, you know, bouncing down the river. They don't know how to control a boat as a paddle boat captain. Or if they have to make 20 miles that day into the wind, they don't know how to, you know, entertain their crew. There's a lot of tricks to getting a boat down the river in flat water, just in terms of pacing it, they're doing the pacing and keeping the boat in the current that you don't learn gear boating. So I think we'll always do paddle boats in the Middle Fork.
Do you guys think that part of the reason why there's less commercial paddle boats is just stopping guide complaining?
I'm like not going to answer that question. Oh. Eric, go ahead.
guides would rather row paddle assist than take a paddle boat. Most of them would. Cause it's
guides are control oriented individuals.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have more control when you have a set of oars. Like like, I know for me, I mean, I tell when we have our like guide training or whatever, and I talk about the different kind of boats we run, I say that, like, I am a control oriented individual and I like having oars because it gives me more control and it suits, it fits my nature and inclination as a human being is to be in charge. So that's why I like it. That said, I do have a lot of younger guides, especially like on the Nugget Powerhouse, like half day section. I've seen like the last 2 years, a huge growth in my guides that actually are preferring to guide stick, you know, especially if they're running that trip twice a day, every day for, you know, 25 straight days.
Wait, Eric, you guys run oars on the Nugget section?
Oh yeah. Okay. All the time. I would say, the first couple of years we didn't run many, you know, we started doing that trip like 15 years ago or something. The first couple of years we did mostly guide sticks up there and then switched over to oars, and probably 80, 90% of our trips were stern assist trips until the last like 4 years where we've had, you know, guides, especially after, we had a few outside guides come in and start guide sticking it quite a bit. And I think a lot of the young guides saw that and thought it was really cool and really impressive and started doing more and more of it. And so now we're probably 25, 30% of our trips up there are guide stick trips.
I prefer the one trip I went there, I loved it with a guide. Like, I don't call it guide sticking, but I love just straight paddle boating. I loved having a guide stick. I thought it was fun.
And from a management standpoint, there's a lot of positives to having your guide stick. You're not losing oars or breaking oars or having to have as much equipment. You know, all of a sudden you've cut out. If you do a guide stick trip versus a stern assist trip, you've cut out what, like
$1,000,
$900, thousands of dollars worth of equipment. Yeah.
But so, also the most dangerous thing on the river are those oars.
Totally right.
And in with a paddle boat, I mean, Aaron, I keep seeing photos of the Tuolumne, people getting the Tuolumne. We used to have 6 or 7 people in a paddle boat. I'm seeing photos with paddle assists with 3 or 4 guests in a boat. So yeah, just for efficiency.
Well, and it's interesting. Like, that's the way it's going there. It seems like as everyone's doing that. And, I still like to take the paddle boats even on a one day. I feel like you can do it if you do it right. But
one day paddle boat on the tee.
We used to do that all the time, Zach.
Yeah, I know, but that was back in the day when we were young.
Yeah.
But I didn't do that many one days back in the day. I think that's another thing is that on the Tuolumne, the trend of moving from 3-day trips and 2-day trips to mostly 1-day trips, it's just hard to put that many miles in with a paddle boat. It's not that big of a deal if we were doing it once or twice a year at 2,500 CFS. But when you're doing now, guys are probably doing 15, 20 day trips a year. It's just brutal to do that many paddle boats. So I can see how they are all just doing paddle assists just to make the miles.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's something to be said for that. I also feel like though, when you do a paddle boat, you're like, all right, like Eric mentioned before, you're not throwing a frame on, you're not throwing on 3 oars. You're not needing all those camshafts. You get to put in, you're like, oh, I'll strap down a couple spare paddles. I'm done. Okay. Let's go rafting. And at the other end, it's easier too. And then I actually find it like tracking the boat is a lot easier when you have a paddle than the oars, because the oars have a lot more drag on them. So the paddle boat actually moves faster if you track it well and just, you know, off the back, especially at the bottom of rapids or anything like that. I feel like I find it just like cruises out a lot better than the oar boat does, the stern mounts too. And because the stern mounts, your weight's on the back. So I feel like I don't work as hard actually in the paddle boat as I do in a combo frame.
I think though, I agree with you. And I've seen on the Middle Fork, I can go faster in a paddle boat than some of the guys with oars in the back. And Vlad, when he, you know, Vlad, Aaron, he's a master paddle boater, you know, he'll be smoking everybody in the paddle boat. And I think it just comes from hundreds and thousands of days of paddle boating, understanding using the currents, going with the flow. And there's just things you learn paddle boating that make you out of a need to do that from doing full day South Forks, full day Tuolumnes and paddle boats, to get to where you can do that. But the average guide who doesn't have much paddle boating experience, they'll go super slow in a paddle boat. They need the oars to make miles.
Yeah, that's true.
I think if you come from Colorado where you're just paddle boating day after day after day, or you're a South Fork American guide where you're just paddle boating, just turning it, you get really good at making miles. But it's a skill that's learned. It's not something that you can just jump in and do.
Yeah, good point.
You're going to end up editing out all the time. And, you know, I think there's a lot of, too, about pacing your guests, you know, only making them take 10 strokes at a time, you know, and J stroking the rest of the way, or having them get through some flats, but then you finish up at the end. There's just a lot you could only learn by hundreds of days of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the funny thing too, Zach, is everyone talks about and complains about it. And you're like, you know, working Grand Canyon trips, they still take paddle boats down there and you're making 40 miles in a day in the lower canyon.
Yeah. Yeah.
You got to find an efficient way to get it done. So, I mean, it can be done.
Oh, for sure.
But I think that one of the other things too, is I think because it's less common now, people aren't seeing it being done. So they don't think it can be done easily. So I feel like it's kind of this spiral with the paddle boating, making it disappear. And people don't realize how it's actually easier in a lot of ways. Like we talked about, like the rigging, bringing my stuff. Like if I were doing the nugget section, no way I'd want to take a frame. I would be like, yeah, let's just take a paddle, throw it in, and let's go.
Aaron, have you ever paddle boated the Illinois?
No, never paddle boated the Illinois.
Why?
Because I'm always working commercial trips, and that's not the way they roll on the commercial trips typically.
Well, Aaron, you just ruined your whole point. That's not how they roll typically.
I mean, from the management down, this is what management's like. Management wants us to take old Falcon.
Oh, come on, Aaron. You run the show on Illinois. You're the management. There's no way the management's telling you what to do. You're Aaron Cavagnolo.
The other one I'll say, Zach, is that Greenwall is a really big rapid, and it's in the middle of nowhere.
And so that's why I don't want to paddle about the Illinois. Two reasons. One, there's a lot more flat water than people remember on that river. There's a lot of long sections of flat. And Greenwall and a paddle boat is full on.
Yeah, that's
super doable. It's not harder than Mushroom. Well, I guess you have oars on Cherry Creek too.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Like what rapid do we run in the West that's harder than Greenwall that's paddle boated routinely?
Oh, I can't think of one. Have you ever run a paddle boat down Cherry Creek, a straight paddle boat?
I watched you do it and decide never to do it.
I probably run Cherry Creek 50 or more times. I've swam 3 times in my 50 runs. All 3 were the day I paddle boated.
Say anything about it, though. Like, that doesn't say anything about paddle boating, right? Like, just about your ability to paddle boat.
No, they were doing dumb things though. One of them was crawling over Travis's inner. Our friend Travis bought a tube because he wanted to tube some of the rapids. So one of them was crawling over Travis's tube. Another was R2ing a portage and flipping end over end, kind of on purpose. And the other was getting slingshotted out of the back in another rapid. But none of them were the major rapids except for Flat Rock. You were there that day, Aaron?
Oh yes, yeah. I saw that. And I was like, paddle boating.
We did great everywhere else in the big rapids. Like we did Lewis's Find and Mushroom Find and all that stuff.
Yeah, 3 swims in one on one day up there though. That's more. Yeah. I think Zach, that's more swims I've had up there in total.
Yeah, that's my entirety of my swims.
Yeah. You don't have no desire to be outside of the boat up there. So.
Yeah. Should we move on to gear of the week?
Yeah, we're just over an hour, so we got to finish this bad boy up.
Zach, do you have any gear of the week?
Oh, why did you ask me first?
Because
you don't have any? I do not have gear of the week. But if Aaron goes, I'll have some here in a second. I just have to look around my office and see something that catches my eye. No, I have gear of the week. I'll go. I'll go ahead, Aaron, then go ahead. Go ahead.
All right, I got gear of the week. Those satellite messengers I think are fantastic. You guys have probably already talked about them on here, but like the Garmin Reach in the spot where you can just send out text messages. It's such an improvement over like trying to use a sat phone to call out and only get half the message. Like I'm just like a huge fan of the text messaging apps to send messages out when you're in remote rivers.
So no sat phone, only a texter.
I think the sat phone is going to, I don't think you really need it if you have the texter.
What happens if you, and Eric, you can help me ask this question because I know you agree. What happens if you're on the road, you have to call a helicopter in, and you need to call the Coast Guard directly? How do you do it?
So I think that's one of those things that's interesting is things vary from river to river, and that's a good point. If you have to call directly, then it seems like you can't have someone call for you, like someone in the office call for you.
Yeah. So that's, I think that in no matter what argument you're making, you can find an exception, right? And that one to me is sort of the weird exception. So we have gone, we don't have sat phones anymore. We've gotten rid of them. Mm-hmm. We are fully sat texting devices, with the exception of the Rogue, where we have a radio phone, because a radio phone is available on the Rogue, and it's actually the most reliable tool down there, I think. Other than probably the sat texting things are probably equally reliable, but the phone, that phone actually works. And so we've stuck with the radio phone down there. But to the Coast Guard point, you're not actually supposed to call them. You can, but you're supposed to call your sheriff department first anyway. But same thing, like, you know, we'd have incident elsewhere.
Call the sheriff's department. What if you have to call the sheriff's department?
So the same, but part of our process for those emergencies is you send a message to the office, and then the office can make that communication to the sheriff's department. Because even with a sat phone, you don't want a sat phone calling the sheriff's department directly, because the likelihood that that call actually goes through, or that they're able to have a full conversation, you know, it's like they cut in and out all the time.
What if it's 10 o'clock at night?
What about 10 o'clock at night?
Is there always somebody in your office?
You know, there's a list of people they can text, from me to our operations managers to three of our head guides. Like there's a chain you go down that's in the kits of people to get a hold of. But yeah, somebody's always around. That's part of our policy.
Here's what I'm getting at. And I'm just asking because I want feedback on this. Let's say you're a river guide and somebody has a life threatening injury and you send that text out. How long do you wait before because you're just waiting for a response. You have no feedback on whether that person is even awake. Maybe they're watching a movie. Maybe they're like, who knows what. So when do you go down that list? Or if that's a life-threatening issue, do you send 5 texts out at once, just hoping the first person to respond can respond?
Well, so you can hit the SOS button on ours.
Oh, yeah, that's
so if it's a life-threatening, like a true life-threatening
thing. SOS.
It's SOS, yeah. And then you get in touch with the management. Got it. So like we had an incident where – you know, a guide was bit by a rattlesnake on the foot, and they hit the SOS thing, and then they got in touch with me. And by the time they got in touch with me next, I'd already been getting a call from the company, you know, the SOS people saying, hey, you know what's going on? Here's the deal. Like, what we're doing. And then we coordinated and actually called off their helicopter that they were sending in for a better method. But yeah, they're reliable. You know, if the message was at least sent, like I'm fully on board, and I communicate with my people now, whereas with the sat phone, it was like, don't call me unless something's serious. And now we communicate once a day, you know, hey, here's the weather. Here's just confirm what's going on. Make sure everything's good here. If you need to know anything, I can send it in. If something weird's happened at the takeout, or your car's not going to be there, who knows? So I love them. I totally agree. Gear of the year. Like it's the best. Well, and they work. Like in places, sat phones don't work because they can't get a strong enough signal. Those signals will still go out. So the, you know, kind of ability to actually communicate is so much better with those.
Yeah. Well, we've gone to them too. We use them on the road. You have access to the radio phones. We don't. So we don't use that. We're using them on the Rogue and everywhere else, except the Middle Fork. We have both a sat texter and a phone. Cause there's just some things a phone we kind of need mainly for if a truck breaks it, take out, we can call AAA. You can't text AAA, that kind of thing.
Not yet. I feel like that's the other thing too, is they're moving towards where everyone, more and more people are accepting texts. Like that's one of the things with the search and rescue and with like the 911, they're becoming, they understand that they need to be able to take texts now because so many people can text. And like, and especially with this backcountry stuff with the satellite messengers, there seems like there's a move to become more responsive to the texting because more and more people are texting.
Cool. So, yeah, I love them. Moral of that story. Zach, gear of the week?
I'm ready. I didn't want to do this because I feel like I've done it before. But anyway, I've been working with Wing to make rafts, do some raft design. And they have a new fabric that is incredibly stiff. And they've only produced one raft with this fabric, and I've been taking it out. And it's in the weave. There's something in the weave that they've done that's proprietary that makes it almost feel like a hard boat. It's really crazy. And I've never been in a raft that's just basically perfectly stiff. It has pretty much no flex. And it's fascinating. It's almost a different sport when the boat doesn't flex at all. And so my gear of the week is Wing's new proprietary fabric that is going to start – we'll start seeing more and more boats over the next 3, 4, 5 years made this way, and it may change things.
Have you flipped it yet, Zach?
I have not flipped it, but I did swim 2 days ago out of it because it was – I'm going to blame it on the stiffness. And I think that's my debate is the downside of stiffness is that they might flip easier. And so I went in to surf a hole, a pretty big hole. I was pulling back, and I was going to surf it like I'm in a cataract. And I normally cat surf this hole, and I went in and surfed it, and it was a – I got a little bit sideways, and it was an immediate, totally sideways, up on one side. And I didn't flip, but I fell out the side. I was rowing it, like a rowing – I had a rowing frame on it. So it's incredibly responsive, but the – it with in terms of flipping holes, I think it's going to be flippier. But otherwise, some people, and I'm having debates with people, some people say it being so stiff means it's going to power through holes better. And I think I agree with that as long as you're straight. As soon as you have any angle to the hole, it's going to do it's going to probably flip easier. But it's really interesting. The fabric's really interesting. It's lighter than the normal urethane. It slides over rocks better. It's pretty cool.
You said it's lighter, so is it thinner? Will it not last as long? Or
they tell me it's the same durability or better. So I, you know, I'm just, you know, this is just them telling me things. I've only had this boat for about a month and taken it out 5 or 6 days, so I can't attest to the durability. But supposedly, whatever they did with this weave, it's some super high tech thing that they developed with the Navy. From what they're telling me, it was some huge grant. It's just a special weave. It's the same coating over the top. But something about it makes it lighter, and I wish I knew more about it. But Wing
sounds awesome.
Wing's going to start coming out with some cool stuff because they have access to some crazy fabrics that nobody else has really taken time to work with. Because they did all some military stuff, they've developed some fabrics and found fabrics and done a ton of research, and they have some really cool things that they can work with that other manufacturers haven't had a chance to work with yet.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, I'm excited to try it out. That sounds great.
Yeah, I'm trying not to push. I like working with them, and I'm buying some boats from them, and I'm helping them with some designs. I'm trying not to push their stuff too hard because it feels like a commercial. But I'm excited to see what they're doing.
Cool.
Yeah, cool, Zach.
That's great. I actually don't have gear of the week this week, so.
I think we need to change gear of the week. We might change it here. Because when I think of, like, I've covered all the things I want to cover, I can't think of new gear every week. So maybe we'll talk later and turn the ending segment into just, like, thing of the week.
Yeah, maybe.
Or maybe just do something else.
Yeah. Well, future decisions.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Well, thanks, Aaron, for being our guest. Thanks for everybody. Yeah. It's great to have you on again.
Thank you. Yeah, it's fun talking with you guys again. Thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure.
Awesome. And thanks, everybody, for listening. Hopefully you were headed out to the river or heading back from the river, something like that. Go out and get on the water train that seems to be out there right now. So, yeah, come back and listen again next week. Have a good one.